We have two cases this morning. The first one is United States v. Campos. Lieutenant Danielewicz, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
I am.
And Lieutenant Nguyen, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Zoe Danielchek, and along with Captain Arthur Gaston, I represent the appellant, Sergeant Juan Campos. Chief Judge, I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The military judge abuses discretion when he considered additional alleged crimes in an unsworn victim impact statement. This tainted the sentencing proceedings and prejudiced the appellant. This court should set aside the sentence for two reasons. First, the military judge erroneously applied the course of conduct framework reserved for evidence and aggravation to an unsworn victim impact statement. And second, the plain language of RCM 1001C does not support such an application. The military judge allowed the victim in her unsworn impact statement to make allegations of additional crimes. But
before we get started into that,
yes, sir,
I'd like to know the lay of the ground here. From your perspective, should this court stop using the Barker factors when we're addressing sentencing errors? Stated differently, should we stop looking at the strength of the government's case, the strength of the defense case, the materiality of the evidence, the quality of the evidence, and so forth?
Your Honor, this court has recognized that in a sentencing case, it is difficult to assess just how much specifically an unsworn statement has impacted a sentence. And when we're talking about the strength of the government's case, specifically in a plea agreement, it's always going to be strong because an appellant is already there to plead guilty to certain crimes. So when we're looking at the potential for a new test, I think that we stay with the third and fourth factors of Barker, which is the materiality of the evidence and the quality of the evidence in question. But there, if we know that an error has occurred, then we know that to some extent the appellant or the accused is prejudiced.
So rather than going through the Barker factors and picking and choosing what would benefit and accused, why shouldn't we simply rely on the old standard of whether the error by the military judge substantially influenced the adjudged sentence? Why shouldn't that, standing alone, be the standard?
Your Honor, I just want to take a second to think about your
question. Certainly.
That could be the standard, Your Honor, but in that situation, what I submit to the court is that if an error occurred, then a resentencing hearing should take place. Because it is difficult to assess.
So wait a minute. You're taking an absolutist approach that as long as an error occurred, there is no test for prejudice?
As long as an error occurred and we know that a military judge considered, for example, as in this case, evidence that he otherwise would not have had access to, we know that the appellant was somehow prejudiced. So I think weighing whether or not it's substantial or not in situations such as a sentencing hearing can be difficult. It's difficult to really grasp and figure out the tangibility of whether, how, just to what extent an accused has been prejudiced. So if an error occurs at the hands of the military judge, then that in and of itself creates a veil of unfairness surrounding the sentencing proceedings as a whole.
So, please go ahead. Wouldn't that revolutionize this area of the law?
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly would. But
and you don't argue that in your brief. This is something you're bringing to the court this morning.
Yes, Your Honor, in answering your question, yes.
So why shouldn't we instead stick with the precedent we have with Barker 6 years, six years back, gone to this relatively artificial not particularly applicable construct of taking the Barker factors, but why shouldn't, even if we were to strip that away, why shouldn't we still be left with the standard of whether it's substantially influenced?
Well, Your Honor, excuse me, not to cut you off, Your Honor. In this case, even if we stick with the substantial influence, that is met here. We know that the military judge considered this improper victim impact and determined that the appellant exuded a, quote, continuous course of domestic violence over the victim. And he specifically discusses the, quote, intimidation and isolation that the appellant had over the victim. But he only is able to get to that intimidation and isolation through the contents, the improper contents of the victim impact statement. So here we know that the military judge improperly considered these statements and then sentenced the appellant to but 2 months shy of the maximum allowable punishment here. So we know that...
Oh, no, you can finish your sentence.
We know that here, in Sergeant Campos's case, his sentence was... He was substantially prejudiced here in this case.
Okay, counsel, I want to go back a little bit before the chief judge's follow-up question, and where you stated that if there's an error, that we should assume or presume that it has substantially influenced. Where does the deference to the military judge go? I mean, are we also tossing that, or is it going to be a sliding scale, or what?
Honor,
I mean, deference in the sense that the presumption that the military judge knows and applies the law.
Yes, Your Honor. Generally, we do presume that a military judge knows the law and applies it correctly. But in this specific circumstance, we know that the military judge wasn't properly applying the law. He's using a construct that is reserved for evidence and aggravation and applying that to RCM 1001C victim impact. So to the extent that the military judge is showing us that he is not properly applying the law, it does lessen the deference that we should give the military judge in that presumption.
Okay, so is that just in this instance because we've demonstrated, as you said, the military judge has demonstrated that he did not properly apply the law, or because you're going to this almost absolute standard, would all military judges lose all deference?
No, Your Honor, I think okay. It would depend on the facts of each specific particular case.
Okay, thank you.
Lieutenant Daniel, Chair.
Yes, sir.
What, in your view, is, and I may ask the government this same question, but what, in your view, is the purpose of the unsworn victim impact statements?
Your Honor, the purpose of the unsworn victim impact statement is to allow a victim to be reasonably heard as to the financial, social, medical, and psychological impact that the specific crimes an appellant is convicted of had on them.
And we've said that it's not evidence, so it's information being placed into the record.
Yes, sir.
What is the judge supposed to do with these statements when they come in?
Your Honor, well, first, the military judge is the gatekeeper here, and the military judge is obligated to ensure that the contents of a victim impact statement stay within the confines of RCM 1001C. So they stay within the social, psychological, medical, or financial impact of the crimes that the appellant was convicted of. So here, the military judge considered altogether separate and new crimes. Those are outside of the bounds of what he was allowed to consider.
But he or she might very well consider the statement, but what are they supposed to do? What is their purpose in considering? Are they supposed to consider whether or not what they've heard should influence the sentence he or she is about to adjudge, up or down, or what?
Your Honor, practically speaking, the way that this should work is the trial defense counsel makes an objection to the contents. The military judge makes a determination as to whether or not they fall within the parameters of RCM 1001C. And to the extent that they don't, then those statements are then redacted from the victim impact statement.
Okay. Now, again, in the judge context, in this case, it seems the military judge considered the context of domestic violence as a continuing offense. Now, I assume since that's how he viewed it, then he was looking at the rule and concluding that this was directly related to to the offense for which the accused had pled guilty. Is that a fair assessment?
Your Honor, the military judge almost recognizes that this was not actually related. In fact, he says, to the extent the challenge statements are not actually related to the actual offenses the accused pleaded guilty to under the additional charge, these statements contain matters considered as a continuous course of domestic violence aimed at the victim, which is proper for me to consider under RCM 1001 Charlie. That was an erroneous application of the law there, because he's telling us he is considering aggravating evidence and using a standard that or a framework that's used for evidence and aggravation and applying it to RCM 1001C.
So your complaint is that what he said was, I'm going to consider this evidence even though it's not actually related. But is there a difference in these contexts, actually related and directly related? Sounds the same, but...
Your Honor, the complaint is that he is considering aggravating evidence in a form that's reserved for non-evidence, which is a victim impact statement.
Right, but I mean, I'm focused on the language in both rules, which suggests that you can consider this information that is directly related to, in the aggravation context, it's directly related to or resulting from, and in this context, it's directly related to or arising from. So if we take off the arising from and the resulting from part of the rules, we're left with identical language in both rules, are we not?
Your Honor, we're left with similar language, but we're left with two rules that are distinct and function separately, and we know that because when we look at the whole text of both of those rules, in 1001b4, the aperture for what a government counsel can introduce as aggravating evidence is evidence as to any aggravating circumstances directly related to or resulting from.
But at the risk of kind of repeating myself, and I hope the Chief Judge will indulge me here, but again, it goes back to what the judge is supposed to be doing with these statements. They're not evidence, they're information. If he says he's going to consider them, what does that mean? Is he going to consider them in giving a sentence higher than he normally would give, lower, or what?
Your Honor, the potential there is that he could consider it as aggravating evidence, thus inflating the accused sentence. And here we know that this new information helped the military judge to conclude that there was this ongoing course of domestic violence. He talks about this, he specifically discusses...
But isn't that the very nature of domestic violence?
When the accused is pleading specifically to specific crimes in a plea agreement, he should not be taken to task now for new additional crimes.
But counsel, wouldn't that, to the extent that in this specific case, we have two episodes that are pled to. So we have the earlier one in 2020, and then we have the most egregious one in 2022. So it would be a reasonable inference, I think, for a military judge to say, yeah, this is probably consistent with the way domestic violence works. These were not episodic, that there was a continuing course of action or conduct, I'm sorry.
Your Honor, the problem here, though, is that the military judge considered statements, specifically the yelling at her, the taking away her phone, and the cutting off the Internet, limiting her ability to communicate with her family. He is taking those statements, and then he is deciding at that point and considering it as intimidation and isolation of the victim. However, the pleaded to offenses don't contemplate intimidation and isolation specifically. They do, yes, Your Honor, contemplate the specific acts by which the accused pleaded guilty to domestic violence, but they do not contribute to this continuing course of intimidation and isolation, thus continuing course of domestic violence that he, appellant, allegedly exuded over the victim.
Counsel, may I ask you about three of the statements in the unsworn statement? And particularly, in asking these questions, I'm mostly interested in if they were improperly admitted, were they prejudicial? So the first one was yelling at me occasionally, obviously not charged, but the accused admitted to that, that he yelled at her. Is there any prejudice from that appearing in the unsworn statement when he admitted that he yelled to her?
Your Honor, he admitted to yelling at her in the context of the specific incidents for which he pled guilty. The way that the the victim's impact statement reads here is that it was an overarching theme in their marriage. It started by, quote, it started by him yelling at me. Then he started pulling my hair. So there, inside the victim impact statement, there are pieces of the crimes that appellant did plead guilty to, but there are other statements, specifically the taking away her phone.
Well, let me ask yes, about sir. The other one. So the other one is having me immobilized against the wall. Now, that wasn't charged, but appellant admitted to, quote, pushing her up against the wall. Is that the same incident?
Your Honor, not necessarily. The language there is different. Pushing someone against a wall and immobilizing somebody against the wall could be two separate instances there. And that's part and parcel what is the problem with this impact statement is we don't know when in time these incidents occurred. And to be quite frank with this Court, we don't know exactly if these instances occurred or if they occurred in the manner that the victim is presenting it to the military judge.
Let me ask about the third one, the grabbing and pulling me on my arms. Now, that was also not charged. And that one, unlike the other ones, there's no sort of statement directly on that. But he did admit to pushing his wife against the wall. Is that the same statement?
Your Honor, we don't know. Because we don't know, again, when in time these incidents occurred. What we do know, though, is that it is new information that the military judge is considering. And under the fourth factor of Barker, if we're staying with the Barker standard, this was not already obvious from the other evidence presented at trial, and it did provide new ammunition, especially when we talk about the intimidation piece.
Now, Councilman, can I just
say two
other things, which is that some of the conduct in the unsworn statement is not really criminal or not necessarily criminal conduct, such as yelling or maybe even turning off the Internet. How does that affect the prejudice?
Your Honor, I see I'm almost out of time.
Please respond.
Your Honor, it's still aggravating circumstances that can provide new ammunition and did provide new ammunition to the military judge here in sentencing the appellant. And here, even one day more of confinement that the military judge would not have otherwise awarded the appellant but for these comments, these improper comments in the victim impact statement, is prejudice to Sergeant Campos. Because he had no meaningful way to rebut those statements. He was not on notice. There was no discovery. There was no cross-examination. Those are all procedural protections that would have been afforded to him under evidence and aggravation. And I see, Your Honor, I'm out of time.
Please.
Well, Counsel, that's exactly the question I was going to raise. Because he did have a means by which to rebut, or at least he had the ability to rebut in the sense that RCM 1001C5 alpha gives the accused the opportunity to rebut any statements. And the accused took, or the appellant took advantage of that, at least with regards to some of the latter information with regards to finance. He did not take advantage of it with regards to these statements that you're raising. And so to that extent, there was a mechanism in place. So it's not like he was completely deprived of due process.
Your Honor, here, practically speaking, an accused is given a victim impact statement potentially just hours before a victim delivers her statement to the court. That juxtaposed with what they contemplated, even in their plea agreement, paragraph E of the plea agreement contemplates that any sort of aggravating evidence will be given to the accused at the very least 5 calendar days prior to the scheduled pre-sentencing proceeding. So here, instead of kind of at the 11th hour, him and his trial defense counsel trying to come up with a way to effectively rebut in some capacity these statements that may or may not even be true, that juxtaposed with the notice that is required, even under the plea agreement, is much different. And it looks a lot different in the fact that the accused could have submitted some sort of statements or evidence to disprove some of these allegations. But he was without that here, and that is where the prejudice lies. There is no check or balance on what a victim was allowed to present here to the military judge, and the military judge considered it. Thus, we respectfully request that appellant's sentence be set aside in this case.
Any further questions?
Just another question. Can I go back to the purpose of the victim impact statement? Now, aside from the expectation on the part of the victim that she is going to influence the sentencing authority, is it possible that another purpose or purposes of the victim impact statement is to provide information in the record for either public consumption or the convening authority's consideration, or even for the victim to simply feel that she has been hurt, a cathartic kind of approach?
Yes, Your Honor, so long as that stays specific to the crimes that an accused has been convicted.
Well, why does the convening authority, if the information is for him, why would he need to be confined to those limits?
Well, the convening authority does make rulings on clemency requests made at the end of trial by trial defense counsel on behalf of the appellant. That could certainly influence whether or not a convening authority is more likely or less likely to grant the clemency request. So
well, I'm not talking about clemency necessarily. What if the convening authority needs to know that this kind of conduct is a specific problem in her command? Isn't that useful information that she should know?
It is useful information, Your Honor, so long as it stays within the confines of RCM 1001C. We're not asking the court to limit 1001C any more than it is already stated in the rule itself. We're just asking that military judges continue to be obligated to be the gatekeepers of the type of information that can come in under RCM 1001C and ensure that it stays within those confines.
Yeah. And then one last question, I promise.
Right.
One last question on the issue of prejudice again. You've indicated, well, how do we know if the military judge didn't give him one more day than he should have? But the one more day approach is not the rule, is it? That could apply in any case, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor. The rule as it currently stands is substantial influence, an error substantially influenced. But here we do know that the error substantially influenced that because we know the military judge is considering these improper victim impact statements as evidence in aggravation.
Right, but do we know whether or not the military judge is considering them in a sense that whether or not he should increase the sentence that he would normally give? Or not? Because I think in this case, as I recall, and again, my memory is not what it used to be, but as I recall, the sentence fell within the range contained in the plea agreement, did it not?
It did, Your Honor. It fell just 2 months shy of the maximum, but there's no telling whether or not the military judge would have sentenced him to 65 months but for these comments. Here we know, though, that he considered it improperly, thus he no longer gets that presumption to know the law and apply it correctly. Therefore, in considering these statements, it prejudiced and tainted the sentencing proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thus, we respectfully request that the sentence be set aside.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Nguyen.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Lun Nguyen, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States. The court should affirm this case for two reasons. First, there is no error, because under Mullins and Norse, uncharged acts can be a part of a continued course of conduct, and it can be considered at sentencing. Second, even if there was error, there was no prejudice to appellant under the Hamilton factors. On the first point, uncharged acts within the victim impact statement are admissible under Mullins and Norse because the appellant's convicted acts, which consists of twice assaulting his spouse in a series of domestic violence, were a continuing course of conduct under the meaning of Mullins.
Well, just to be clear, we've never endorsed that rule, right? That application of that rule to an
unsworn.
Yes,
Your Honor, you're correct. This is the first time that this court is considering whether or not the Mullins definition of a continuing course of conduct specifically applies to information admitted under 1001 Charlie.
Right. So that's one of the reasons we're here, right?
We're figuring out
whether we're going to allow military judges to do that or not. So make your pitch.
Yes, the pitch is that, Your Honor, first, Mullins and Norse has established that uncharged acts can be considered as sentencing since the 80s, since Vickers even. And second, both rules, RCM 1001 Bravo as well as 1001 Charlie, contain significantly similar language, and particularly the same language that Mullins and Norris relies on to say the continued course of conduct is within the meaning of directly related to.
So do you want to go?
Counsel, appellant says that if you want to bring in this kind of aggravation evidence, you call the victim to the stand, put her under oath, ask her questions, subject her to cross-examination, and there's no problem with introducing this continuous course of conduct evidence as aggravation, according to the appellant. It's just you can't do it in the victim impact statement. If you want to do it under Mullins, you put the victim on the stand, put her under oath, and subject her to cross-examination.
You're correct, Your Honor. There is the means of the prosecution, the trial counsels, to admit it under 1001 Bravo as aggravation evidence following the rules of evidence. But in this case, the 1001 Charlie is not under the right of the prosecution, it's under the right of the victim to convey the information, to give her statement to the court for consideration. And that's why there's a distinction. Aggravation evidence is evidence under 1001 Bravo. Under 1001 Charlie, is just for matters of consideration by the military judge.
How is that constitutional when the victim hasn't made any Brady disclosures, when the victim hasn't provided any kind of discovery, when there's no advance notice as to what's going to be put into the victim's statement?
So that question sounds by constitutional, I'm going to presume whether or not there's a due process issue with regarding to victim impact statements of 1001 Charlie. So we haven't, the United States hasn't briefed that specifically. However, we can submit a supplemental brief, but just facially speaking, I do have the rule here. Whether or not there is a due process issue, the test is whether the factors militating in favor of appellant's asserted right are so extraordinarily weighty as to overcome the balance struck by the president in this case, and that's by Weiss. So the first step under that test is to look at the historical practice, which I already mentioned before. Since Vickers in 1982, uncharged acts as part of a continuing course of conduct can be considered by the sentencing authority. And the second step is to consider the number of safeguards in place to ensure impartiality. So as Judge Johnson mentioned before with my colleague, there are numerous safeguards under 1001 Charlie. One of them is notice. So the rule specifically does say that after findings, the victim or her counsel or his or her counsel has to provide written proffer or else a written statement. And here, that's what happened. And in fact, the appellant is incorrect that he only received notice hours before the victim impact statement. In fact, it was delivered to appellant's counsel 2 days before sentencing and 1 day before findings, in both the form of a written proffer by counsel himself, as well as the copy of the written statement.
But isn't that a period of time so that they can go through and cross out and say, that is evidence not pertaining to an offense of which I've been convicted, that is not evident, that is not relating to a crime of which I'm convicted, as opposed to now I've got to put on a whole new defense case against a bunch of allegations that I hadn't seen until a day before?
Not at all, Your Honor. It's part of the process embedded in 1001 Charlie. So the court has already discussed before that the military judge is a gatekeeper here, and it's his duty to ensure that the victim impact statement is within the scope of 1001 Charlie. And in this case, that's what he did, because after notice, the appellant made objections in a 39A hearing before on the day of findings, before sentencing, specifically on two objections, one on under 1001 Bravo and 1001 Charlie. So there was significant amount of time for the appellant to, one, receive notice and then make proper objections. And of course, he specifically only objected to really the financial impact, but didn't really say on the record that he was opposed to the other uncharged acts, such as yelling at the victim or taking away her cell phone.
But counsel, in appellant's reply brief, appellant says, but you put the accused in a very difficult position, which is, look, I'm really sorry for the offenses for which I've convicted of, but I'm not sorry for the other crimes which I haven't been convicted of. because I didn't do them. And it doesn't come across very well first of all, it's very limited because it's only an unsworn statement that the accused gets to make. But secondly, you put the accused in a very difficult position where he either has to admit to offenses for which he was not charged or he has to sound not contrite.
Yes, Your Honor. So specifically in this case, and even in other cases, the appellant had the option to exit out of his plea agreement if he was vehemently objecting to the victim impact statement. And additionally, the victim impact statement carries the same innate nature as the appellant's unsworn statement. They're both unsworn. You know, there's nothing to say that that both parties were absolutely truthful. But at the same time, 1001 Charlie, unlike with 1001 Bravo, is not evidence. And to the question that that Judge Sparks brought up, like, how is the military judge supposed to consider this? At this point, the United States believes that because it's not evidence, the military judge is supposed to give less weight to victim impact statements if it was admitted under 1001 Charlie as opposed to aggravation evidence in 1001 Bravo because it's not evidence. And furthermore, on the record, and this goes towards the prejudice analysis too, but the military judge made on the record that he was not considering this as aggravation evidence, and he said that he wasn't going to consider it as support evidence or suggestion that the appellant committed additional acts other than the offenses he was actually convicted of. It's not in the joint appendix. I didn't add it in the supplemental joint appendix, but it is page 189 of the record if the court is interested.
Counsel, so even putting aside Judge Maggs's concerns, if you can, then I don't understand how the application of the rule, this legal rule, to an unsworn victim statement is even consistent with the President's discussion of Rule RCM 1001C that follows. It says a victim statement should not exceed what is permitted under RCM 1001C3. I mean, that seems pretty clear to me. We're not going to apply a rule to broaden the scope of what's allowed. And then it says, helpfully, a crime victim may also testify as a witness during pre-sentencing proceedings in order to present evidence, such as evidence in aggravation, admissible under a rule other than RCM 1001C3. So why isn't that the answer to the question raised in the briefs of, is the language similar enough that we can apply a rule from a different context to this context? It seems like the discussion is very definitive that says, no, you shouldn't apply some other rule to broaden the scope of RCM 1001C3. What's your response?
Yes, Your Honor. So 2 points. First, the United States is not saying that anything outside the scope of 1001 Charlie should be admitted. However, we argue that the meaning of victim impact statement, that includes these uncharged acts because, again, we look back to Mullen and we look back to another even the current day comparison of the two languages, another significantly similar language is the definition of victim impact. It contains the same definition of victim impact. In 1001 Bravo, it says victim impact includes financial impact, psychological impact, and such. The only difference is that this court or prior court hasn't applied that definition specifically to 1001 Charlie. However, we look at the similarity of the languages as a reason to properly apply the Mullins analysis, because the idea is like victim impact in order for a court to properly consider the true impact, and that's the quote-unquote key word here, true impact on a crime victim. We have to consider the additional circumstances, such as other uncharged acts as part of a continuing course of conduct, and Mullins made the test for that. Like, what can be properly considered as a continuous course of conduct? It's same or similar acts, same victims, and similar situs within the military community. And that's what the military judge found here. He found that it's the same appellant, it's the same victim, it's essentially the same types of crimes, domestic abuse, and then it was within the same time frame and within the same place since both the appellant and the victim lived together.
Lieutenant Wen, I'm still stuck on what the judge is actually supposed to be considering in these impact statements. I mean, what is the expectation that the judge is going to do with them? I mean, as I question the defense counsel, and I'm truly perplexed about this. I'm not just asking the question that as an abstract thought, but I really don't know what the judge is supposed to do with this information. And some of it has to do with what the purpose is for having this information in the record to begin with. And so maybe you can help me out here. What is maybe your view? I'm curious, maybe not you personally, but the government's view on what these statements are for. What is the purpose of putting these statements in the record? Is the judge supposed to consider whether or not he or she should give a higher sentence, a lower sentence, or is the judge simply saying this is going to be considered as part of the record for informational purposes, for the cathartic effect it might have for the victim? What exactly? You see what my
problem is? Of course,
Your Honor. I'm apparently the only one who has this problem, but that's okay, you know.
So the government maintains that while 1001 Charlie is not evidence for purposes of sentencing, the military judge and the trial court is allowed to consider it for sentencing purposes. So it could have it can possibly influence the judge's decision, but it's.
How do we know though? Once he has considered, so to speak, the sentence, how do we know whether he is considering it in the sense of increasing the sentence or reducing it?
Well, of course, the military judge or the sentencing authority could explain on the record. And in this case, he said that he was going to make sure that it was considered, one, as 1001 Charlie considerations, and not for any uncharged acts. But, of course, in terms of safeguards in the military justice system, if it's found that the sentence was inappropriately severe, then obviously there's always the Article 66 and 67 appeal as well. But in this case, the government believes that the safeguards are proper, and just as this court held in Hamilton, victim impact statements don't carry the same. Just going back to the test.
Maybe the same weight.
Less quality necessary to affect the military judge's sentence.
His sentence calculation?
Yes, Your Honor.
No, I was just simply saying, okay, I think you've answered my question if you wanted to move on. I hate to hold up the act here, but thank you very much.
And then just moving
counsel,
on to...
Well, I have a follow-up question before. So if it's the government's position that the military judge can and perhaps should use the unsworn victim statements to factor them in when they sentence the accused, then the accused has a due process right that we're worried about, and the victim has a right to be reasonably heard that we have to balance. But in balancing those two, why would we not construe unsworn victim statements narrowly? Because we're trying to balance the accused constitutional due process right against the victim's statutory right to be heard. And if we have questions about how broad the president intended or did RCM 1001C3 to be, why wouldn't we construe it narrowly to protect the accused's due process right?
Yes, Your Honor. So the United States relies on Hamilton to argue that military judges are presumed to know the law, to know the differences, and to understand how to weigh the evidence, the considerations, and that's why this court decisively said that that based on this type of consideration, it wouldn't affect the sentencing, as the appellant there argues. And then And that could even be seen in other precedents outside of the specific issue here. The military judge is obligated and presumed to know how to handle these considerations. He understands what unsworn means. He understands how much weight that that should be given. He understands that there is one dozen one Charlie and one dozen one Bravo.
But how does that play into the fact that we could be signaling to military judges that even if they're improperly allowing in extraneous material, that there is a provision here where we're simply going to say, we're going to presume you know what the law is. And so if the military judge at the beginning of the process is not making that determination about what is extraneous, improper material, and saying that should not, that cannot come in, why are we then going to sit back as an appellate court and say, you didn't get that part right, but we're going to presume you know the law, no harm, no foul? Why doesn't that put an accused in an impossible situation?
Of course, Your Honor, obviously there's always possibility of error. Judges are not necessarily perfect. But by legal standard, a presumption is just a presumption, and that could be pierced, right? And it depends on the record.
So if a military judge does not recognize clearly extraneous, improper information that should come in, does that, standing alone, pierce that presumption?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. May you repeat that one part again?
So if in the front end of this process, military judge, I'm not speaking directly about this case. If a military judge does not recognize that there is extraneous material that should not come in the victim impact statement, does that, as you worded it, pierce the presumption in terms of an appellate court, whether CCA or our court, then says, we're going to presume the military judge knew the law and applied it?
Admittedly, it does make it easier for me to like look at entirety of record, but the United States believes that absent any obvious error, aside from just the possibility that it might be outside the scope, the United States believes that there should be more, especially if it's on the burden of the appellant to raise the error to the appellate courts. But if sorry, just to make sure that I answer properly. The information or the statement is like obviously outside the scope. I would say just based on that scenario, if it's that obvious, that it should be pierced. It's within the court's discretion to pierce it. And again, it's just a presumption.
And you finished it. So I want to follow the logic thread. So essentially, in this instance, though, your argument is that based upon Mullins and Norse and the fact that within a domestic violence context, a continuous course of conduct is appropriate information to come in, that in that context, the government would not characterize that as extraneous or improper information.
Yes, Your Honor. But of course, we do believe that not just any domestic violence necessarily continuous course of conduct. The military judge did on the record.
Yeah, the criteria. We'd meet the same. Yes. You know, same side, same victim, same.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Correct.
I see your time has expired. Questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Nguyen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Daniel Check.
As my colleague intimated, Your Honor, A presumption can be pierced when it is obvious that a military judge has considered something that is outside of the scope of RCM 1001C, and it is obvious here. We know that the military judge considered these improper statements as evidence in aggravation. And we know that because he applies the Mullins and Norris construct of continuous course of conduct that this Court has reserved specifically for evidence in aggravation. He applied that to an unsworn victim impact statement to then consider these new allegations. And new allegations do not fall within what is attributable to the specific crimes that the appellant was convicted. Thus, we know here that the presumption that the military judge knew the law and applied it correctly was pierced. And because of that, we know that there was prejudice to the appellant when he sentenced him to about 2 months shy of what he bargained for in the plea agreement. So if a judge is telling us that he is considering this victim impact statement for all intents and purposes as evidence in aggravation, then we know he's doing that to formulate a sentence. And that is improper here, and it is error. This is exactly why military judges have to be mindful that what they are allowing to come in the contents of a victim impact statement must stay attributable to the offenses for which an accused is being sentenced.
Isn't the problem more that the military judge needs to say on the record what he or she is considering in the impact statement? Isn't that more the problem? Because if the military judge lets the statement in as a whole and then says, well, I'm not really going to consider this stuff over here, then there's no problem, is there?
Your Honor, it would certainly illuminate the military judge.
Let me ask you. If that had happened in this case and the judge had been clear on the record about what he or she was going to consider in the impact statement and not consider, would that have made this problem of yours less of a problem or no problem?
I think it would be a little bit more difficult to pierce that presumption, but we know here that he tells us he is considering it as a continuous course of conduct.
No, I'm asking you, is the problem here is that if he was going to not consider certain things in the impact statement, shouldn't he have said so on the record more clearly than he did?
Your Honor, if he was not going to consider it, then he should have just had those statements redacted from the victim impact statement, and there would
Why would you have to do that?
That way we know that there's no question of unfairness here.
Well, you don't trust him if he says it on the record?
Well, Your Honor, when he's misapplying the law, then he should be given less deference.
Well, let's assume he hadn't misapplied it yet. Let's say he announces that, hey, look, there's some stuff in this impact statement that really I shouldn't consider, and I'm not going to consider. But the statement as a whole is coming in because it's not evidence, it's information.
Your Honor, I think to protect the accused and to protect the military judge, then we should use the mechanism of simply having these statements redacted.
Why do we need to protect the judge?
To ensure that he does not make an erroneous ruling or does not consider something that's improper for him to be considered.
Well, if he announces that he's not considering it, he hasn't considered it, has he?
Well, we have to weigh that with how he's applying the law throughout the court-martial. And so if he is not applying the law properly throughout the court-martial, then we know or...
Yeah, I'm not going to belabor the point because you only have a limited amount of time and the Chief has already...
Which has expired.
Overindulged.
Apologies, Your Honor.
Any further questions?
No, sir.
Further questions? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:30.